Okay. Now it gets weird because it's like definitely recording. This is actually really good for me because now I'll know how my test subjects feel when I'm recording them. Which is because I'm like, oh yeah, just talk away. And I think now that I'm in this kind of situation with being recorded, I'm understanding this whole observer's paradox, listening, recording type thing that makes it really difficult to get sort of natural speech.
I think there's also an element of teaching. I think maybe teaching's a bit like this. In that you're saying to folk, talk, and they're saying, well, talk what about?
Yeah, totally. See, that was one thing that really annoyed me when I was an undergraduate, that hardly anyone would talk in the class, and you'd be like, it would end up, the tutor would be like a sort of mini lecturer, and you would just be talked at for an hour because they had to do something to kind of fill in the time.
Yeah.
Was really good at that, actually.
Actually very good though. She's got a good knowledge base, and she...
Yeah, totally. But it was just really annoying. Not annoying because she was talking, but because everyone else just wouldn't. It was just like they'd all be sitting there going, well, I don't know what to say. Let's just be quiet for an hour and someone else will talk. Yeah. And that really, really annoyed me.
One of the things is like, I think this year I've inherited classes from other people.
Right.
So in English you don't teach for the full year, you teach, you divide it in modules.
Uh-huh.
So you teach either 1A or 1B.
Right.
And I'm doing 1B, which means that I've got a class who, for five classes, all of whom have already been brought together, and we've been getting to know each other with another tutor, who paradoxically, one of whom was one of my old tutors.
Oh, right.
And I've told them this. Yeah. I just said, you know, I actually...
Yeah.
...taught me as well.
Who is it? I don't know.
Right. And I always feel as if everyone has a different styles.
Yeah.
Teaching, obviously, feel as if they're kind of expecting me to do things in the way that she did them.
Yeah,
and I'm not either able or willing to do that.
Yeah, because you've got to get your own sort of teaching style. You've got to find it, and yeah. I think emulating someone else, like to an extent, is good. But I think you've got to try and find your own way and your own feet and do it.
But also, I mean,
so you're comfortable like teaching your own style.
It's also different as well when you've got like you get three months, your first time at university, and the job of the tutor is to kind of is to get people feeling at ease and to just get like things flowing and to put people in and put people at ease. But then by the time you know you're 3 months in, you need to pick up the pace a little bit. You need to kind of be expecting a little bit more engagement, a little bit more involvement from people.
I think I made it really obvious that they weren't talking when they weren't. I was just like, so everyone have a good weekend. No, I was just like, well, and you know, thanks for that, I appreciate it. And I just made them feel like, you know, yous aren't talking, yous have got to do this. And they seem to be getting somewhere now. Like the past couple of tutorials, it's been really good because they've started actually talking and asking questions and thinking about things, which has been really, really good. But it's only a certain amount of people who are like that, and then the rest of them are just like, not very talkative. But I've been trying when I see them outside of class and stuff like that, and actually stopping and going, hey, how you doing, you know, we're doing alright, so that kind of informality gets back into the tutor group and people feel as if they can kind of chat and stuff like that. I took them for a drink at Christmas time to say, you know, good first terms work and stuff like that, and I think a lot of them were like, a minute, he's taking us for a drink, what's going on? But I think they really enjoyed it because it gave them then a chance to like chat about stuff totally informally in a situation that's not, you know, like a classroom, which I think was really, really good for them. What kind of stuff is it you're doing in 1B with them?
It's, we've got quite a lot of poetry. We've got, today was Wordsworth and Coleridge, we've done Donne and Herbert.
Right.
I've got two more poetry sessions, and they keep saying, I hate poetry, and I keep saying that's why it's compulsory.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Which is the case.
Yeah.
You know? I've got a session on I've tried to kind of group it just chronologically, so I've got a session on sort of modernist,
right,
it's basically Eliot and Hopkins. It doesn't quite fit in that modernist mould, but it was quite kind of influential, you know. And then I've got a session on modern Irish poetry.
Alright, cool.
And I don't quite know how I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to do something about like I better be careful about how cliched I go into what I'm talking about, but I think I'll do something with I don't know, Yeats and Heaney, and something on artistic response to violence, and do you know, something like that. I don't want to get into the, I think you can deal with these things in a really cliched way, you know. I feel like kind of a responsibility not to do that, but also I think that people are not very, they don't get political enough about their poetry. I mean, sometimes, I mean, I come at things from quite a kind of politically engaged angle in terms of the questions that I ask tend to be questions to do with language, power.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the times though, like undergraduate students are kind of unwilling to get involved in these kind of big-headed debates, like not so much about the poetry, but about the sort of political dimension of it.
Yeah.
Why that is, I don't know, but I definitely, when I was doing like Scotlit and poetry stuff, I wasn't really willing there to get involved in the whole political side of things, and even in novels, not so much poetry, but novels as well, like I just didn't really want to deal with that, because it's complicated, I think. It can get messy, and people, I think, might. People get a bit emotional about it. It can get a bit emotional about it as well, especially Irish poetry. Like,
there's going to be a lot of resonances and things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things, what I tend to be looking at in my own work is about political implications of artistic form.
Mm-hmm.
So why write this way and not that way?
Yeah.
It's a really simple question, but that tends to be what I'm, one way or another, talking about.
Yeah.
Cool. So when I come to doing Wordsworth, then I mean, I'm not especially sympathetic to the Romantics,
mm-hmm.
and I ended up talking the other day about Wordsworth and Marx.
Right.
Just because it's like, you know, what are the political implications of the Romantic sort of favouring of the country over the city?
Mm-hmm.
What are the political implications of this? Thinking about Marx and, you know, the Communist Manifesto saying about abolishing the difference between the town and the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the political implications of this apostrophe to nature that you get in Wordsworth and Coleridge, you know, in reaction to the Industrial Revolution? And some people weren't really interested. Others were like, oh, all of a sudden I've got an angle on this.
Uh-huh.
It just depends on the personalities and on the...
Yeah, definitely.
Because you've got to find, I think, some way of, like, especially in poetry when you're always looking at quite dense, formal patterning.
Yeah.
You've got to find some way of saying, well, why bother with all this formal stuff?
Yeah.
What's the point to it? What's the... And obviously you don't have an answer to that question, but what might be some...
Yeah.
Some ways of thinking about it.
That sounds quite cool.
It can be, but that was the one good class out of five. The other four, I didn't fall flat on my face, but they weren't very successful.
Yeah, I had one class like that so far this term. In fact, it was only because I didn't really prepare it well enough. And we were talking about the semiotic triangle, semantics and stuff like that.
What, Saussure?
Saussure, referent, signifier and all the rest of it. So we were talking about that, and hadn't actually managed to copy down the diagram, and I didn't do semantics. I only did semantics in first and second year, and really didn't know anything about it. And I'm like, yeah, this is what this means. And they're like, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, no, actually, just give me a couple minutes here until I read my tutor notes. And they were like, oh my god. But I made up for the next week. Like, I actually spent time like sitting and reading up and sort of Middle English Chaucer stuff, so I was able to go, boom, 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 this is what it's all about. And I think they were a bit more impressed by that.
Well, your reputation's so important, isn't it? I mean, I feel very subconscious sometimes about when you're off form.
Yeah, oh, I know it was simply not because I didn't know the material, it was because I never prepared it. And semantics is just something that I've never really been particularly interested in. But Middle English is a bit easier. And next week it's social linguistics, I'll be in my element.
Whereas I kind of feel that, like, if I had a class on teaching Alistair Gray, I'd feel quite nervous because I'd be thinking, well, you know, all of a sudden that's what I'm supposed to be able to do, and then I'd be certain, well, how do I teach this stuff to beginners? How do I kind of go? I'd love to be asked to do it.
Yeah,
obviously I'd love to be asked to do it, but.
See, that's the thing, when you've got to teach something that you're not really sure of, it kind of consolidates your own knowledge base as well, because you've got this opportunity to go and read up, and then you've got to be able to teach it. And that was one thing I was taught when I was doing my undergraduate. You don't really ever know anything until you can explain it to someone else. And if you can explain it to someone else and they get it, then you know, you'd really know about it because you're able to sort of...
Which is what writing essays is about, which is what the... Basically, an undergraduate essay is that same process. It's,
yeah.
It's showing that you understand enough to explain it to a third party.
See, I found it really odd, actually, that I can explain a lot more in an essay and then it just kind of goes out of my head. I can figure things out and link them all together on paper. But if you actually asked me to do like a lecture on exactly the same material, I wouldn't know anything about it. I would just be like, what did I talk about here? Mm-hmm. But it's quite weird that it's easier to keep your thoughts coherent on paper, but then it's a lot more, I think it's a lot more difficult to do it orally as well, but I don't know if that has any currency or not.
I think it depends whether you actually read from a script or not. I think if I'm in a lecture, I'll be reading from a script.
Yeah?
Because the thing about, I wouldn't be, there it is, standing at the lectern just reading, but I would definitely have it, because with the stuff that we're working on is not so much practical skills at the lecture level, uh-huh. That's when the tutorial comes in, but it's not like saying, well, like, you know, John Corbett works through, quite often makes use of PowerPoint.
Yeah.
I mean, he's talking about grammar and semantics and you know, those kind of things, yeah, for undergraduates. That's a great way to do it. You put up your basic kind of concept, your information, yep, and then you just kind of
expand on it.
Yeah. You kind of work out with the students what makes sense or doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You take people through it like that.
Yeah.
I was at a class yesterday on Gaelic phonetics, actually.
Oh, wow, cool. Who was doing that?
The new professor of Celtic.
All right, cool.
In fact, that's how he pronounces it.
Yeah, I did know got promoted.
Yeah, yeah.
As well. I met him a couple of months ago. He came into work and I was like, actually, I'm a professor now. And I was like, all right, congratulations. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, he's one of my supervisors.
Is he, yeah?
Yeah.
Who?
Along with...
Right.
So the two profs.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. Has found anything out about our Viva yet?
I understand that she passed.
Right,
I haven't spoken to her personally, but I heard, uh-huh, I heard that she'd passed.
Brilliant, excellent.
Like, obviously, I didn't hear before she heard, but mm-hmm, she must have spoken to somebody. Spoke to,
yeah, yeah. Scotland department seems to be growing in strength. That's pretty good.
Well, it depends. The thing about it is, I mean, how many people are going to get decent contracts? I mean, without... And do you know she teaches, mm-hmm, Scots language, yep, in this department? Yeah, a nice person.
Mm-hmm.
Without, I'm not sure that they could teach the courses quite as well as they do,
right,
because both do lecturing, and I think, mm-hmm, and he does a bit.
Right,
I think does a bit as well.
She never ever taught me, but I've heard of her.
I mean, she got her Viva passed last year.
Right,
And they both do quite a lot of teaching and there's a lot of admin, but I mean, I don't know the details of their contracts, but they don't have proper jobs.
No, that was when I spoke to. She was saying that she was only on a 0.6 contract or something like that, and they didn't know whether they would.
Permanent either,
yeah, it's not. She said it wasn't at all.
And the other thing, the other problem is that the department is facing decreasing student numbers at the moment.
Right. Well, that's
for whatever reason. So, I mean, I would say definitely let's get the money, give and both jobs,
mm-hmm,
because they've both got specialisms, but they're both really good in general,
everything else,
general,
yeah,
kind of ways as well. And I haven't been taught by either of them.
Right.
Although I've been to kind of papers that he's given, certainly.
Right.
I don't think I've been taught by them. I might have been, I can't mind. But, you know, they've got good reputations as teachers,
mm-hmm,
but that doesn't necessarily mean that the money's going to be there to give them the jobs, because,
yeah,
it would strengthen the department immensely,
yeah,
if was able to turn around tomorrow and say, right, you've both done X number of years or months kind of showing us what you can do.
Yeah.
Here's a salary, here's your teaching responsibilities, go and write some articles and let's get some work done.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know if the department's going to be in that position.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I don't think that there's enough done at high school level to say to people, look, there are there are a few universities that do specifically Scottish Lit, because I didn't know that Glasgow did Scottish Lit when I came in.
I mean,
and it was only English language, sorry, English Lit did English language because of the whole honours system, you've got to do English language, and then did Scot Lit, found out purely on by my supervisor. She was like, oh, we do Scottish Lit, by the way. And I was like, okay, I'll do that as well. But I think if they did more at high school level and said, you know, there is a whole, you know, other corpus here that, you know, you do Scottish literature instead of English literature. But then they don't do enough with English language either. Like, I never even knew that there was so much stuff in English language.
Because
like,
they do in England, of course, they do, like, a separate
level. Yeah, they
level
do A-level English language,
English
language, yeah.
They don't do enough linguistic study. They don't do, obviously, anywhere near anything like enough Scottish language stuff either.
Spocker in high school, the subject, predicate, object, complement, adjunct stuff, that was it, in fact, and that was in fourth year. But when we did fifth year, there was nothing. It was all literature.
They do have a lot of nonsense in higher English, though, a lot of kind of stuff which the teachers hate to teach, you know,
yeah,
kind of very, but which apparently the government wants people to. What they're doing is they're putting a pressure on teachers of English to provide all these critical skills, mm-hmm. which teachers of almost any humanities subject could be asked to bear part of the responsibility for.
Yeah.
Like, writing essays in history gives you kind of critical tools and critical skills, you know. And they're asking that, you know, it's now called higher English and communication.
Yeah.
So that half of what they're, I mean, that's one reason why I don't want to be a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The only times I considered being a school teacher would be if I got to teach Scots language.
Right. See, that was the thing, you can kind of do that, but then it's all this whole, I don't know, national treasure thing, like Scots language, you teach it on Burns Night type thing, which I think, you know, you do Scots language through Burns, and then you maybe do a little bit of Tom Leonard or something like that, but you don't really do all that much about the grammar of it, the phonetics of it, how it's different from standard English, this whole standard English Scottish continuum, you know, where you use it, why you use it, the historical developments. You don't do anything like that, and it's such a shame.
In simple terms, I just think that on day one, primary one, then people should come in and they should get, like, count to 10 in English and count to 10 in Scots, and just work its way through, right through the education system.
See, I totally. I think, like, they need to do something about getting Scots on a more even footing. And even if people are bilingual, but, you know, I think if that happened and people are able to code switch effectively between the Scots and standard English, it would be really good. And then you're totally discouraged from writing in it as well, speaking of which, I've still to send you those essays.
Sorry, because I got them off the corpus.
Did you? Oh, right.
Because mine's published now, yes. I did read them.
Cool.
I mean, the thing about it all is that I'm forever saying things like that when I've just forgot what I was about to say.
My friend does that. He's like, that's one of his catchlines. The thing about it is,
and what it is, it's the space you spend like 4 seconds it takes. It's like if you read, you know, orally transmitted poetry.
Yeah.
And it's full of these lines that are like, which appear, if you read them on the page, to be repetitious.
Yeah.
But what they're there to do is to allow them.
They give you a couple of seconds to remember
what he's going to say next.
Yeah. But that's, he always says that, and we always just burst out laughing when he does it, because I don't think he realises it when he's doing it. It's just totally subconscious until we go, you've just said it again, you said it like 2 seconds ago. The thing about it is, and it's always when we're discussing, like, not arguing about something but debating about something, and it always seems to precede like some sort of hair splitting point, and
right,
you're like, come on, like, give up, really.
Funny because I'm learning Gaelic at the moment, and one of the things that's kind of lacking in my Gaelic conversation is those kind of phrases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just sort of filler
phrases, because you need them.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely.
You need them, whereas you quite often hear me like using lots of okays,
mm-hmm.
and lots of so's.
Right.
And some things like okay have kind of made the way into Gaelic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people will use that.
Yeah.
When you
converse in Gaelic, like, how proficient are you?
I've been doing it, I've got 18 months university Gaelic.
Right, cool.
Which means that I can read a bit.
Right.
And I speak broken Gaelic, and I switch between Gaelic and English a lot.
Right.
Because I don't use it very, like, every day.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, because my flatmate, he's Welsh.
Yeah.
And when he talks to, like, his mum and his dad and his brothers and stuff like that, it's really, really funny to listen to him, because he'll, like, big stretches of Welsh, and then all of a sudden he'll just slip into English, and then it'll be all Welsh again. And it's really interesting, like, hearing him kind of code switch between using English words and then using Welsh words, but he uses these English words normally when he's swearing. Actually, that's maybe a
point. I wonder about Welsh, because Gaelic, apparently, the concept of a swear word apparently is alien to Gaelic.
Right. All right.
Like, the idea that a word in itself has value.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Right, so in English you can, or in Scottish you can, like, your series of different words for parts of the body, you know?
Yeah.
And one word you would, like, use in, if you're teaching,
mm-hmm.
right? Another word you would use down the pub,
mm-hmm.
and with different people, different ages.
Right.
Whereas in Gaelic, I think they just, like, words don't have moral value, so your arse is your arse.
That's quite interesting.
So the concept of swear word is alien to, as I understand it, to Gaelic.
Uh-huh.
Traditionally to Gaelic.
Yeah, because there's been loads of work done in English as well, saying that, you know, a swear word's just a swear word. It's not any worse than any other word, like a table or whatever. It's just the kind of... It's interesting how a meaning... A judgment meaning has been put on top of that.
I wonder what that's got to do with the, like, sociolinguistic history of
English
and Northern French and Latin.
I wonder if it's more cultural than anything else. Because I don't know, like, being sort of... I would think that Gaelic's quite a nicey language, I suppose. I don't know whether English is maybe because of all the sort of strife that it's actually gone through. To get where it is now.
I don't know if it's so much that idea, because I think it's just a very specifically cultural idea that words can have of themselves a value, but you can still abuse people in Gaelic,
right?
But you do that by calling them, like, if you think about the English phrase "son of a bitch,"
mm-hmm.
there's not a swear word anywhere in there,
yeah.
But that is a kind of taboo phrase in the context in which you use it.
Well, would you say "bitch" is swearing?
I would say bitch is swearing in that sentence.
Right.
Because it's a developed phrase. Whereas if we're talking about dogs, well, that's a bitch.
See, that's the one thing, like, my girlfriend, or mum, keeps dogs. And when she says bitch, like, I can't but help automatically think of the swearing word connotations rather than the gender of the dog.
Aye.
I'm just like, you just swore. And no, Robert, it's the dog. She's a bitch.
Yeah.
But it's really weird that that's just associations in my head now.
I mean, you can take that far enough and say that then, you know, cow could become a swear word, you know, if you talk about women or, you know, this. And I think that's what happens. I mean, not in any means, like, knowledgeable about this, but I gather that's what happens in Gaelic, where they use, like, phrases. But the words themselves aren't of value, but, like, it's in the context.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wonder if religious words have value in Gaelic,
like, because
the concept of blasphemy must still exist in Presbyterian.
Because in Middle English, that was the thing, like, religious terms like God's bones and God's teeth and stuff like that. They were the bad words.
Yeah.
But obviously, that's kind of all changed with the sort of de-Christianization of sort of English culture, I suppose. But in Middle English and Chaucer and stuff like that, that was the taboo words. It would be quite interesting to actually look at swear words. There's a girl doing some work just now on slang, and I think she's looking a bit at swearing in Glasgow, in Glaswegian, which would be quite interesting. Hopefully I'll look a bit at that as well when I come and actually do my research, because I've not even started it yet. It's really bad, but I've got a meeting tomorrow.
When's your deadline, kind of October?
I think it's end of September, so I think I've got, like, 2 months groundwork, 2 months recording, which should take me up to the school holidays, and then transcribe it, analyse it, write up some sort of preliminary findings, and then get it written down.
But a lot of it will be transcripts then, and things like that. You mean, in terms of how much you have to write, do your transcripts count in part of your word count, or is that appendixed?
I don't know. All the other theses that are, or is it thesi? all the other stuff.
Theses sounds quite funny.
Yeah. All the other ones that I've read have all the transcriptions actually included in the main body of the text, but I don't know whether they've counted towards the word limit or not. I don't know whether they would, but then I suppose they probably should.
I think
because they're part of like your argument, like quotations get taken into your word count.
I think it just depends on like, I think doing social linguistics, you're in a funny position because you're sort of straddling kind of arts and social sciences in terms of how the rest of the academy views what you're doing.
Yeah, social linguistics seems to be the kind of, I don't know, it's getting a better, it's got recently a sort of better reputation being a lot more scientific and stuff like that, especially with like in the 60s with the whole growth of like Lavoisier, quantitative social linguistics and stuff like that. But even he, I was reading this last night in fact, even he says this whole social linguistics, looking at the relation between language and society, that's not what we should be doing. You know, we should be tabling stuff, counting things and doing it like that, because that's a scientific thing. And he says like he regrets the whole concept of social linguistics because he doesn't think that that's what it's all about.
Right.
But it's got better, and even our department, like, we've only got one social linguist.
Is that
Yeah, but she's hoping to get another one, in fact. But there's loads. She's got like loads of postgrads doing work on different bits. And there's myself. There's, I don't know if you know her.
I think I've probably met her actually.
The
what about doing some social linguistic?
That's her job.
Well, she's postdoctoral.
Well, I don't know if she's post. I don't know if she's got a doctorate. Does she?
Can't remember.
But she's actually working. And then there's, who else? There's a girl called. There's loads, and she's had like some really good thesis work coming through the past sort of 5 years or so.
Yeah.
But well, this
says something when you've got, you know, one member of staff in an area, but they've got a disproportionate amount of postgraduates.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, all the work that we're all doing is all on Glaswegian. We're not really doing anything else. Like, all my work's on Glaswegian. All the work is on Glaswegian. Obviously all the Jane's and works on in Glaswegian. Hers in Welsh, actually. Welsh and English code switching. Which is a bit hard to do from up here, so she has to do it through questionnaires and stuff like that. She went down a couple of weeks ago to a school in Wales and said, you know.
Is she a Welsh speaker herself?
Yeah. Wenglish. She can speak Welsh, but she kind of really forgot a lot of it when she came up here for uni. She had to kind of try and reteach herself before she went down, so she was able to talk to the kids and stuff like that. But yeah, I think she's maybe the only one who's not doing anything in Glaswegian
right
just now, which is really, it's cool. There's like so much stuff going on here.
It makes a lot of sense to be using the materials that you've got to hand, you know.
Yeah,
I was doing some work in one of these moments of, it's actually not from a PhD, but it's kind of, I did this paper last year on, it's kind of a misleading title, called Sectarianism in the Scots Language.
Right.
And I did the arguments about the kind of Scots language literary revival of the early 20th century.
Right.
And I'm looking at people like William Souter, and I'm trying to say that the kind of catalyst behind this, behind, for some of the writers, linguistic tactics is a response to Irish immigration.
Right.
Okay. It sounds really tenuous when you just hear it out of the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I put this argument together about like, what is the cultural context in Scotland in the 1920s? Why after 200 years of parliamentary union with England, why a nationalist movement now? And not, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 200 years ago, yeah.
Well, I mean, probably, I'm sure there was 200 years ago. But do you know why now? What's special about now? And I'm looking at kind of some of the strategies to do with literary Scots writing,
right,
and talking about like linguistic choice, like the privileging of Germanic over Latinate vocabulary,
uh-huh,
on the basis that the Latinate vocabulary is stigmatized as English,
right,
and then paradoxically they then go back to kind of Anglo-Saxon cognate,
yeah,
languages to get to. And there's a lot, there's kind of a political kind of subtext to a lot of what's going on here.
Is this a paper in progress?
I did it as a conference paper last right. year, and then I've got to revise it for publication.
Right.
And I'm going to turn it into a kind of a, a more sort of developed essay.
Ah, that's cool.
But one of the basic so you've got this idea like that it's destructive to like, you know, we both written essays in Scots, right? And my attitude is always don't stigmatise classical vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
A television's a television's a television.
Yeah.
Right?
Rather than a farseer or something like that.
Which is something that, in fairness, like as far as I understand, the Icelanders do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Germans do as well.
Yeah. Yeah, right? their words fernseer, I think.
Whereas if you go into like in Gaelic, it depends on the word.
Yeah.
Right? So television in Gaelic is television.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, like
it's spelled differently, is it not?
Yeah, because the Gaelic alphabet doesn't have a V.
Yeah.
But that's the only difference.
Yeah.
Well, no, actually, there's one other difference too, but it's just phonetically
right.
television in Gaelic. Because if you think about television, like a farseer.
Yeah.
Right, well, that's what it literally means, but that doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what it now means.
Yeah.
So the word itself has acquired kind of value and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So they've kept that word. But then the word for internet.
Uh-huh.
Is Aetherlyn. I've got a very bad Gaelic accent. Aetherlyn.
Right.
Aetherlyn. Which literally means internet.
Right.
Because it's the net which joins up, the connecting net.
Yep.
Right? So that in that context it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was actually thought out as a good word to Gaelicise.
Yeah.
Whereas they decided that television they would keep. I don't know if that was just habit that dictated that or
yeah.
or whatever, but but they, you know, there's a certain approach to it. Well, my attitude is always television, television, television.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at kind of linguistic choice in Scots like writing in the early 1900s onwards,
mm-hmm.
and between the wars. You know, at the time when the Church is publishing, the Church of Scotland's publishing its and the menace of the Irish race to our Scottish nationality and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. But the main kind of impetus for all this is that if you look at the Scottish National Dictionary,
mm-hmm.
There's a little. This is why we talk about like the work in this department on Glaswegian is so interesting.
Ah.
Is that if there's in the Scottish National Dictionary, an introduction to Volume 1,
right,
published 1933, I think, right? If you look at the introduction, it's like set out in kind of bullet points, like
right.
numbered, like, you know, 1.1, and then it goes on kind of thing. Well, about 14 pages in or something,
mm-hmm.
it says. There's this one little thing which says, due to the influx of Irish and foreign immigrants into the industrial area surrounding Glasgow, the mm-hmm. dialect has become hopelessly corrupt.
Yeah. Right?
So
yeah.
right there at the centre of this monumental work of Scottish scholarship,
mm-hmm.
which begins in the early 20th century,
mm-hmm.
right, to catalogue the distinctiveness of Scots speech.
Yeah.
They ignore the city of Glasgow, the biggest city in Scotland, where huge population. They just ignore Glasgow.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, it's okay to catalogue like the Norse influence on insular Scots.
Yeah.
And it's okay to catalogue kind of the Romani influence on
yep.
on my dialect of Scots.
But
you know,
it's
in the southeast. But we're not going to touch Glasgow because Glasgow's full of foreigners,
mm-hmm.
Irish people, you know, et cetera,
yeah.
et cetera, et cetera. And so Glasgow is left out entirely. Mm-hmm. Of the SND,
mm-hmm. It seems that seems to be really endemic, though, that urban Scots seems to be bad, sort of correlated with bad Scots, and rural Scots is good Scots,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's an impression that is even right up to the modern day. That, you know, you go and ask a school kid, you know, do you speak Scots? They'll probably say no. But there's so much Scottish things going on, but it's just become so intimately correlated with, you know, if you speak an urban variety, then you're speaking, you know, it's bad Scots, which is a real shame.
It's not as if like
but it's interesting that that's kind of gone along with Irish immigration as well.
You shouldn't accept it, but I'll put the argument in.
You think that's a main factor or a contributing factor?
I think that the impetus, the cultural nationalism, mm-hmm. which we had in the early 20th century in Scotland, mm-hmm. part of the driving force to this was a feeling that Scottish culture was under threat as a result of immigration.
Right.
And that is part of the kind of the context in which you have the poetic revival, mm-hmm. you have some of the scholarly, I haven't really looked too far into scholarly projects yet, but based on that thing in the SND, I'm thinking, well, this is the cultural context in which people are beginning to worry about Scottish culture, mm-hmm. they're beginning to worry about the survival of Scottish culture. Why in the early 1900s? And then the thing I was looking at yesterday was Jameson's Dictionary.
Right, yeah.
Right? And the introduction to Jameson's Dictionary, and a guy put me onto this at a conference.
Mm-hmm.
The introduction to Jameson, because it's interesting, I'm not really a linguist, but I end up, you know, because of the questions I ask, I end up going down these kind of routes, mm-hmm. and you're having to ask a lot of advice off linguists.
Right.
You know? But the introduction to Jameson's Dictionary, all it is it's a racial tract saying that the Lowland Scots are descended from the Picts.
Uh-huh.
The Picts are a Germanic people,
mm-hmm.
who came to Scotland and this, you know, the northern part of this island, which, mm-hmm. you know, for descending further south than what's now Scotland, from you know, northern Germanic Europe,
mm-hmm.
They were different people from the Anglo-Saxons. They spoke a Germanic language, and the language that the Lowland Scots speak today is a direct descendant of the language that their Germanic ancestors spoke when they first came to. When they first came to this island, right? Mm-hmm. So what they're basically saying is that he spends a whole thing, it's called Dissertation on the Origins of the Scottish Language,
mm-hmm.
and all it is a big tract trying to completely dissociate the Lowland Scots from any Celtic providence,
right.
at all. Instead of saying the Picts, this is 1800 or something,
mm-hmm.
instead of saying the Picts, we don't really know much about them.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the language that the people in this part of Scotland speak is some form of Germanic speech,
mm-hmm.
with various influences.
Yeah.
Right? We know that. Where they came from ethnically, we don't really know.
Yeah.
Instead of saying that, he goes out of his way to say, whoever they are, they're certainly not Celtic.
Mm.
Right? So there's a whole kind of... And that's what forms the introduction to his dictionary.
Yeah.
That is the introduction. There's no kind of...
Mm.
It's almost like the you know, the impetus for Jameson writing his dictionary is influenced by this kind of whole racial politics, you know, mm-hmm. which obviously has got implications for the relationship between Highlands and Lowlands,
mm-hmm.
the relationship between Scotland and Empire.
Yeah.
You know, and where are you in the imperial kind of context? Mm-hmm. Are you powerful or are you disempowered?
Yeah.
I keep digging up and digging up and digging up, uh-huh. and I'll hopefully finish it, and then everyone can go rubbish.
No, it sounds quite interesting. Like, it definitely wasn't anything. Like, I don't know whether it would, like, just going by what you said, whether it would be a main factor in the kind of revival, or whether it was kind of contributory factor.
I mean,
but it is
talking,
interesting,
yeah.
to see why, like you say, a big revival and a kind of cultural revolution in kind of some kind of way happens 200 years after, you know, we kind of get taken over by England.
I mean, I'm looking at a specific number of writers,
uh-huh.
and it's definitely like, I'm not really talking about spoken Scots, I'm just talking about the kind of academic and literary
mm-hmm.
movements of the period, rather than a kind of more broad-based popular.
Right.
And certain people like Hugh McDermott gets exonerated. And one of the things I'm trying to do is to say that, like, is to get rid of this idea that authenticity is a good thing. I want to forget authenticity.
Right.
I want to say what is artificial is good because that's freedom. Do you know what I mean? I want to get away from this idea of authenticity, because I don't think authenticity is achievable. I think it's a pretense whenever you claim to be authentic in writing. I think there's a bit of pretension going on there.
I think it's probably more pretentious to be artificial.
Right.
In a lot of ways. And what McDermott did, admirable as it kind of was, I think was academic arrogance right. in a lot of ways, and that for that reason I don't really like McDermott, but I think he went sort of deliberately out of his way to be really obtuse
in places. He certainly did, yeah.
And what's the point? Like he even says, you know, that he wants his poetry to be read by, you know, the kind of average Joe on the street.
Hokum, you know.
But that's yeah. that's not the language that the average Joe on the street uses. I mean, a tummy book, you just, you know, it's not the language that normal people use. And from a linguistic point of view, like I had really big problems with McDermott, like really big problems. Some of his stuff, his English stuff is really interesting, and his Scottish stuff is interesting from a linguistic point of view, but not for the reasons that it's, you know, new Scots. It's this whole plastic Scots it really strikes a chord with me. I think he was really pretentious, arrogant to think that he would single-handedly make the Scottish language new and accessible to everyone, but I just think that he went round about it completely the wrong way.
I think he's often given too much. Too much weight is placed upon him in terms of yeah. what he's expected to have achieved.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, McDermott undoubtedly is interested in, you know, the Scots language in a social way,
yep.
and he's interested also in Gaelic, and he's interested
yeah.
in these things, you know. But on the other hand, he's a deep in the dyed modernist poet.
Yeah.
In the same, you know, like. T.S. Eliot mm-hmm. in a different way, and not like T.S. Eliot in lots of ways, but or like, you know, he's got a big admiration for James Joyce,
mm-hmm.
you know. So on the one hand, he's got his politics,
yeah,
but he's also got his artistic ambitions,
yeah.
And it's funny that McDermott kind of says something like, well, because, you know, when he kind of moved away from Scots later in his career,
yep.
and he almost says, well, I can't do this on my own,
yeah,
right. And
I
it's
think
almost
that
if he
would
says, I wish. That Scots language would be, you know, higher, because he's so socialist after all, so
mm-hmm.
it would be better considered and we'd have a better place in the community, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm not necessarily going to do that myself.
Yeah.
I've also got a vocation to be a modernist poet, and one of the problems when we look at McDermott is that, well, first of all, his own pronouncements
mm-hmm.
are often, I think, quite unhelpful in terms of reading his poetry.
Yeah.
But he's almost like he's being judged according to a criteria that he would never have seriously tried to achieve on his own, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know, like,
because that's why, like, I love the early McDermott.
Uh-huh.
But when I write in Scots, like in prose,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't write in that fashion, because I'm not trying to achieve the effects that he's trying to achieve in the Bonnie Brook at Bairn or the Water God, or,
yeah,
you know, because it's just different kind of,
yeah, I think
purposes,
like,
you know?
The whole, you can't create a language. It's just not the way that the language works. It's a dynamic kind of self-monitoring system in it. You can't change a single. You can change a single language, exactly like you were saying there. But from what I can understand, that maybe earlier on in his career, he felt as if he was good enough to be able to do that.
Yeah.
To be able to single-handedly change it, and I don't know. It's a shame that he never achieved, but this whole lack of standardisation, and he was using words from kind of all over the place, you know, from right up the top of Scotland, right down the borders, kind of all over the place, trudging old dictionaries and stuff like that. I think if it had been a bit more standardised, and they've tried to do that, but I don't think that in our lifetimes, I think Scots is probably going to go down rather than up.
It seems to be quite a mixed situation in terms of across the different schools, or certain schools where it's
yeah.
very, very. I mean, I think the poet that got, because I don't know if poets are really the people to look for this sort of thing, but I think the poet that got, that writes in the most kind of sort of standard kind of form is probably Robert Garrigue.
Right, I've not read any. Well, I think I've read a few bits and pieces of it, but I think it's got to come from the media. I think once it gets accepted in media and it starts getting disseminated to a larger crowd,
yeah.
And in education as well. I think media and education are the two main sort of bastions of getting this kind of Scots language.
I mean, I think that there's a lot of nonsense that's talked about with regard to kind of linguistic fascism, in terms of the people who say, don't try and standardise Scots, because you know, that's just linguistic fascism.
Yeah. And it's, but see, that's exactly what happened with standard English, though. I mean, and all these dialects going around about, and they went, no, this is the one that's got the most currency, we'll just use this one. And then by a process of media, I mean, it was all printed books and stuff like that, that it became more standardised.
I mean, I kind of say, well, it's just like technology, you know, like, I would be the last person to try and make speech in the country less diverse than it is. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this isn't Tiananmen Square here, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're going to have people going around with, like, tape recorders listening to saying fall instead of what, you know.
Yeah, I think it's not going to happen. I think they only need to have a written standard. I don't think they've got to have well, obviously you can't have a spoken standard, but I think if they get a written standard, then they're you know, the battle's kind of half won. But that's the thing, you look at this, like the SND, you've got so many different spellings for so many different things. I mean, do you spell fall without an A, with an apostrophe, with a W? I mean, how do you spell it?
I mean, I think the most positive way I can find of thinking about standard written Scots is just to say it would be useful to have a standard form available. Mm-hmm. Right now you don't have to use it,
yeah,
but it's the one that we're going to teach in schools.
Yeah,
right, that's all we're going to say. And Tom Leonard's not going to use it, and Irvine Welsh are not going to use it. Well, why the hell would they?
Yeah,
you know, they don't need to. It's not that's not their purpose.
Yeah,
you know, it's not what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And you, no one's going to go around telling an adult how to write letters. No one's going to go around telling an adult what to do when he writes a letter to the newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, but when you're going to teach kids, then you've got to have. But it's just technology. It's just like a technological
tool.
You pick a system, but it's not like you're trying to say, do this and don't do that. It's just that if you don't give teachers some kind of resource, then they're going to go, well, I mean, we've done it. Like, how much time did you waste trying to?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when I was writing my stuff, it was a case of what I felt was Scottish, and then if I wanted to go get a Scottish word or whatever, you know, look up the SND and try and get a translation. But I never, like, I remember having this conversation with you last time, like, I never ever wrote straight off in Scots. Mm-hmm. My mind just isn't wired for it now. I wrote in English and then translated, which I think you kind of lose a lot of the
idiomatic kind of nuances of it.
But that's the only way I could do it, because when I was growing up and getting taught, it was standard English. So when I'm writing now, I've got to think in standard English. There's no way that I can do anything else.
See, I think my English flows better having written the Scots, because I think more about flowing spoken English now.
Yeah.
But when I didn't write in a standard form, mm-hmm. or anything. Like, I definitely marked out my writing as I used hui, W-H-A-E.
Right.
And I used yin.
Right.
And I used certain other forms, which are definitely kind of, just like when I had to choose between a form, like, I would never say, I couldn't use whore, because it's where I come from, right? I wouldn't use brack, I'd use breck.
Right.
Know, like, time for your breck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you from again?
East Lothian.
Right.
Although I've lost my accent completely. Uh-huh. But I definitely marked it all out as in these forms. Mm-hmm. But I mean, It's not all the huge amounts of kind of phonological difference, mm-hmm. more than you can cope with. I mean, if you're going to use something like a wall, mm-hmm. right? In my dialect, that's pronounced away.
Yeah. Nah. See, I would never say a wall. I would always say away.
But the broadest Scots speakers,
I would say a wall.
But where I come from, the broadest Scots speakers would say away.
Right. Right.
Because it's almost like Tyneside.
Uh huh.
Right. And as far as I understand it, like it's not twa, it's tway.
Right.
It's away, mm-hmm. in the same vowel,
yep.
and it's not what, it's way as well. It's always like where it's kind of central Scots has the O,
South
East Scots is kind of an A sound, yeah. right? But if I read like a book and it says a wa, I'll just pronounce it away, mm-hmm. because that's my dialect, and it doesn't bother me.
Yeah,
you don't need to overspell, you don't need to spell everything out.
Yeah.
If we did that, we'd be using the IPA,
yeah.
and no one does that.
Yeah,
you don't need to represent everything in,
yeah,
you know.
I don't know, I think it'll be interesting to see, because I know there are a lot of initiatives going on just now in schools and stuff like that.
John's got involved, isn't he?
Yeah, they're doing I think it's himself and Jeremy, I'm not sure, are doing a reader of Scots grammar. There's maybe John and Simon, I can't remember. It's one of them.
Simon Horbin.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure who it is though. But they're doing a Scottish grammar.
With schools in mind, or
yeah, yeah,
right.
And they were involved in setting up exam questions and stuff like that, I'm sure as well, for the SQA.
Right.
But yeah, they've been an awful lot involved in. Obviously, John's written, you know, a book on Scottish grammar, Scottish and Scottish literature.
Oh, and language of Scottish literature. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
As well, so they're all really involved in it, but I don't think it can't come from universities. It's got to come from primary schools. It's got to start, like you say, 1 to 10 in English and in Scots. It's got to start there, I think, and then just pick a system and they stick to it. And I know, like, talking to John and Jeremy and stuff like that all these kind of Scottish language meetings and stuff like that, it gets quite animated. You know, how do you spell for, you know, like, and people get really emotional about it, and then it always comes down, you know, they spell it like this in Lothian, they spell it like this in Borders, they spell it like this in Highlands. That's all well and good, let them spell it like that where they, when they want to, but there's got to be a standard, there's got to be some sort of,
the other thing is, like, when I'm writing, I'm thinking, well, I'm trying to keep an eye open and say, I don't, if I'm being, like, completely selfish, I may not like the look of that on the page, but what is the current trend?
Yep.
What is the current trend? And because one of the things about spelling is that you want people to be able to just read very quickly.
Yeah, which I think is really difficult. Yeah, because when I was reading in Welsh, I couldn't, like, you had to kind of either read it out loud or spend a lot of time reading it.
Yeah.
And my friend Emma, she couldn't read it at all, because she grew up, it was all standard English, and she's quite middle class and all the rest of it. But she couldn't read Irving Welsh at all. She just couldn't get a hold of what she was seeing on the page.
I mean, I think with someone like Irving Welsh, you'd probably say, "Go fuck yourself."
Yeah.
But because I think that in the context of some of this writing, there's a certain element of trying to challenge you.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
from a literary and political perspective, you can see, like with Leonard, for instance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
If you didn't understand what I'm doing, just get the fuck out my road.
Aye, aye.
Or something like that, kind of Leonard says. Totally balderdise and paraphrase Tom Leonard, but in that context, it's like, so the difficulty might be part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think we'll wait and see what happens, and hopefully, you know, over the next sort of 5-10 years or so, there'll be actually movements.
It's about like political will, to be honest. It's about, I don't mean political will in a top-down way from Holyrood.
Yeah.
I mean political will in a, do the people want to do it?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they do, because I think there's so much negative feeling about Scots.
I think it varies a lot regionally.
I mean, that all comes back to this whole urban-rural thing. You go up to, say, Aberdeenshire, you know, up there, Scots is good. You come down to Glasgow, Scots is bad.
But also in Aberdeen City, Scots is good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't know, I think that's a lot. I mean, even though it's still north, and it's still quite in a sort of rural, secluded sort of area, whereas I think, you know, Glasgow is right in the central belt, it's really industrialised a lot round about it, whereas kind of Aberdeen's just kind of dumped there and a lot round about it.
The further south you go like this, it gets less prestigious.
Yeah.
So that in Dundee City, you're starting to change. Like, what, between Aberdeen and Dundee, you're starting to get less sympathetic. Till in Edinburgh, which has got huge amounts of traditional Scots features in it, which Glasgow has, won't say lost. Glasgow Scots has developed in a different way, you know. And then Edinburgh Scots, I imagine, is more traditional. It's more developed. It's more conservative than Glaswegian Scots is, perhaps.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know. I've never really looked at Edinburgh. Scots.
I mean, just from a vocabulary point of view, like the verb ken is still used in Edinburgh all the time,
right?
Whereas in Glasgow, it's not really heard much now. Or do you hear it a lot in your studies?
I still use ken.
I think it's heard in Lanarkshire. It's definitely heard in Ayrshire.
Yeah,
but I think actually,
but I don't know,
in Glasgow itself, in the city of Glasgow.
Yeah, because I've not really heard all that many like recordings and stuff like that of the kids of like the informants actually talking, because a lot of the Scots got like a lot of the media work that's been done just now is all on school kids.
Yeah.
So there's like a whole range of recordings, because they're all the ones who. Well, I mean, they're not looking at you know, how Scottish is Glaswegian. They're looking at, you know, how's language changing how's the Scots language changing in Glasgow? But I don't know how Scottish it is, and that's one of the things I'm kind of looking at, I suppose, as well.
It's kind of a loaded question, but I think as far just like as a layperson, my perception is that Edinburgh's kind of a more conservative form of Scots than Glasgow is or has been in certain ways.
Yeah.
Just anecdotally, just like the certain things which have survived or have not moved, changed as fast in Edinburgh. Like, you still hear a lot of hui, where you don't really hear hua much in the centre of Glasgow.
Yeah, I think there's I think there's like different, like obviously different pressures and stuff like that that's happened in Glasgow that's maybe not happened in Edinburgh.
Yeah, of course. And I think like the immigration's part of that, but I mean, one of the reasons that I'm quite agitated by this research that I'm doing is that why is immigration necessarily a bad thing, you know? And there's
I don't think it's viewed well, not in Glasgow. Well, I don't know.
I think it depends where you are.
Yeah. See, this is the thing. Like, I think there is definitely divided in opinion whether immigration is good or bad. You get all these like kind of reactionary people. Oh yeah, you know, immigration's really bad, and from a sort of economic point of view, that's, I think, they're focusing on that. But I think in Glasgow, like, the numbers of immigrants that we actually get from a linguistic point of view is like obviously kind of reinvigorating Glasgow region, I suppose. But
I mean, I stay in Govan Hill now.
Right.
I moved down the south side, and that's kind of an area kind of which has had a history of immigration in the last kind of couple of hundred years. So it's very interesting listening to people.
I think it's quite an uncomfortable area to be looking at, though, because I think it has like the potential to be quite racist in its kind of orientation when you start like looking at immigration from, like, I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like,
what, as an area of study?
Yeah.
I mean, the motivation behind my study is kind of is very politically sort of there are people who are disguising in the 1920s and 30s. A kind of antiquarian Scottish concern, and what they're doing is they're actually using that to disguise
a kind of
absolute racialist kind of politics, which I want to kind of expose.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm saying.
That's
kind of
that's the motive behind what I'm doing.
Yeah,
it's kind of just to say, well, actually, you know,
they're basically racist.
Well, not. I mean, I don't want to be kind of, because you don't want to get right down into talking about authors all the time, but there are implications to what is being done here. There are political implications to these artistic choices, and there's a political context in which this has arisen. And if we're going to talk meaningfully about early 20th century Scottish culture, we just can't do it out with the context of changes in society at the time and how that's affected. Yeah. You know, and that's, you know, I don't want people to be saying, for some reason in the 1920s there was a renewed interest in the Scots language and they were all good left-wing people.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's exactly why I would be quite uncomfortable, like, kind of looking at it because I think it would be quite disturbing to find that that's what the reality was.
But I'm not saying it was for all people. I don't think it was hugely important to McDermott, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it necessarily made a great deal of difference in a lot of contexts, but I certainly think it was part of the prevailing climate.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Which I think is a bit more interesting than just saying everybody who wrote in Scots 1920s was a socialist. Well, they weren't.
Yeah, definitely.
You know?
I don't know how. It would be interesting to see, because you don't really get a lot of things just now on writing and immigration. I don't think it's a big deal just now.
I don't think it's a big deal in Scotland anyway.
Yeah, I think that's what, like, you've got two camps, like people who do think it's a problem and people who don't think it's a problem. I don't think it is a problem. But it would be interesting to see maybe in 50 years or so, 100 years or so, people looking back and seeing if there's the same kind of correlations that you're kind of looking at in the sort of early 1900s.
I think it actually affects, like, if you look at say if you compare the writing, it's going to be like rural Scots and urban Scots, right? And I'm not going to mention anybody in the other camp because I don't know if there's a really big representative of it. And I've not worked very much on contemporary Scots language poetry, like the kind of Lowlands movement poetry. Yep. But if you look at like urban Welsh, Tom Leonard, James Kelman, I don't know if you've come across Sahil Saadi.
No.
Right?
No.
Glasgow writer, and his first novel, Psychorag, is set in and around Paul Shields.
All right, cool.
Right, Glasgow Asian writer, and that is kind of important to blind users.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole kind of, there's a lot of, he uses a lot of Urdu in his Scots.
Yeah.
How naturalistically, I don't know, and I'm not sure that he would necessarily be bothered by naturalism. It's kind of a thing. But if you look at this whole, you know, explosion in urban Scots writing in the 1990s, you know, from Kelman through Irvine Welsh and now Cyril Saadi, then, and then of course it's got its precedence beforehand.
Yeah.
And you look at these group of writers, and you start to think, well, why aren't, you know, why is there a division between like a Lallans group of writers and and these kind of urban writers, and what's what is the difference? What is the, why wouldn't Irvine Welsh adopt these kind of strategies?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the difference is obviously poetry and prose.
Yeah.
Because there's not been a huge amount of Lallans prose.
Yeah, no, yeah.
But Bentegogo is a rare kind of example.
I think I've heard of him, but I've not read it.
It's like, because it's science fiction, then he gets around the whole thing. It's a futuristic world. They can speak, science fiction always does that. Always creates new languages for itself, doesn't it? I think it's like, part of the division is poetry and prose, but part of it's also rural urban, and it's what's kind of going on with.
Yeah, see, I think that's like, that's definitely one of the things like Tom Leonard does, that urban Scots is just as intrinsically valuable as rural Scots is.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's actually one of the poets who's really good at this whole dichotomy between language and literature. He kind of brings them together really, really effectively. He's really, really good. Like, I think some of his stuff's fantastic.
Very crisp in what it's, in his perspective.
Yeah, because he notices things that I think everyone notices, but no one says anything about.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, things like the 9 o'clock news and the chap drinking beer and listening to the classical music and stuff like that. It probably all happens, but no one ever talks about it.
Tom Leonard is where I got the whole thing about the Scottish National Dictionary,
right?
Because he says, you know, my language is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not my every. No, that's the end line. But the first one is, my language is disgraceful. You know, my wife telling me, it goes down, and one of the lines is, even the introduction to the Scottish National Dictionary telling me,
right.
And at that point, I say, hey up, what's going on here? And the other thing is, it's like, is it impertinent to say, well, Tom Leonard's a Scottish Catholic? Is that impertinent? Now, and if you go to American literary studies, right, people are doing this kind of stuff all the time. They're saying, well, we've got like particular concerns from people in different kind of communities, religious, ethnic, whatever kind of communities, you know. Whereas Tom Leonard, he's often talked about as the Glaswegian champion, you know, has this line, even the introduction to the Scottish National Dictionary tell me. And when you follow with the reference is, owing to the influx of Irish and other immigrants,
Glasgow's hopelessly corrupt.
Right? And that's it. And Tom Leonard, I mean, we know that Leonard has comes from, like, you know, a Catholic community. Mm-hmm. He's got an Irish surname. I mean, you just start to think, well,
with all the links,
what is he saying? Mm-hmm. What is he saying? Is he talking about I'm being excluded because I'm Glaswegian, or is he saying that because I'm something else?
Yeah.
And there's because a certain kind of heritage. don't mention sectarianism.
Yeah.
You know, like, and Scottish nationalists are terrible for this as well, because like, I mean, I'm working a bit on kind of, like, I don't think sectarianism is the right word.
Right.
Because I think there's anti-Catholicism and there's anti-Irishness, and they don't always coincide, you know? And that's just one side of the thing, you know? I don't think sectarianism is quite the right word, but I'm working on these kind of questions quite a lot.
Ah. Yeah, we were quite happy here.